The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we have a very special show for you this evening, so much so that we're going to depart from our normal format. Tonight, we're going to focus on the performing arts and speak with two exceptional women who lead two extraordinary organizations. First, you will hear from Katie Clark, the president of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, or BAM, as we all know it by. And she'll be followed by Kara Medoff-Barnett, the executive director of the American Ballet Theater, ABT, which is America's national ballet company. So after this word, we'll get right to it with Katie Clark of BAM.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
There are few performing art institutions in New York outside of Manhattan that have a national reputation. And there are fewer still whose name is recognized and revered across the globe. But one of those would be the Brooklyn Academy of Music, commonly known as BAM. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight the president of BAM, Katie Clark. Good evening, Katie, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are an historian by training.
Yes.
And the Brooklyn Academy of Music has a rich, rich history. Share with us some of that history and maybe a pivotal moment or two along the way that has helped make BAM this internationally recognized institution.
Sure. So the Brooklyn Academy of Music actually started in 1861 and we're the oldest continuously operating performing arts center in the country, which is something that people are sometimes surprised by. And in 1861, Brooklyn was a city and there was a civil war. So those are two interesting things to look back on. And I would say that the other sort of pivotal moment was 1967. That was the year that Harvey Lichtenstein came to BAM. At that point, the institution had really declined. And Harvey's arrival ushered in a huge sort of artistic renaissance at BAM. And then there was the era of Harvey and Karen Hopkins and Joe Melillo. And so that brings us more or less to the current day. Also, our original building on Montague Street burned down. So that was the other big moment in BAM's history. And civic leaders in Brooklyn decided that they wanted to build that space again. And they built it in the current location on Lafayette, 30 Lafayette, the Peter J. Sharp building. And so that was the other big pivotal moment in our history.
Yeah, when I think back to 1861, there were no bridges to Manhattan back then, right?
No.
I think the Brooklyn Bridge was 1884, if I remember.
Exactly.
So it
was
really
Yes, in fact, the New York-based companies, the Philharmonic, the opera, used to come on tour to BAM, and they used to bring things on boats. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Well, for listeners who may not be familiar with the Brooklyn Academy of Music, just give us an overview of the breadth and scope of the programming that you offer.
So we now have, in addition to that venue I just referenced, we now have three venues. The Peter J. Sharp building, which houses movie theaters, and the Howard Gilman Opera House, which is a 2,000-seat opera house. Also the Harvey Theater, an iconic New York theater, one of the most beautiful and famous theaters in the world. On Fulton Street, it's a 900-seat theater. And the most recent addition to the BAM campus is the Fisher Building, which was built for a number of reasons, but really gave a home to our education programs, enabled us to build a smaller, more flexible theater, a 250-seat black box, the Fishman Space, enabled us to serve a lot more emerging artists, which has been a huge focus of BAM's, and also to rent space to groups that needed it in Brooklyn. So we have three spaces. spaces now on our campus, and we'll be adding another one actually in the next couple of years. And the breadth of programming, in that sentence, alluded to education, to film, to opera, to theatre, to dance. So we work across many, many platforms and many, many genres, many spaces. And I think one of the things that BAM is most famous for is for the mashups also between those genres, the sort of hybridity of the arts. And that was something that really characterized that artistic renaissance that I talked about earlier on with Harvey as well.
Yeah, that's your secret sauce in so many
different ways. Yeah. Very much so. The Next Wave Festival, which we will talk about.
You know, in what ways does BAM stand for Brooklyn? And by that, I mean, what about it just screams Brooklyn to someone who comes out there, as opposed to, let's say, Manhattan?
Well, I think it's partly to do with the complexity of Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a city of many neighborhoods, many communities, many populations. And so that speaks to the complexity of BAM's programmatic operations, and also this whole idea of local and global programming. We pride ourselves on bringing a lot to Brooklyn for our many, many audiences to see. But that's nearly always reflected in a diasporan community in Brooklyn, too. So there's a lot of exchange between the programs we bring and the communities that we serve.
Mm-hmm. And you also led the growth of the Brooklyn Cultural District, and that community just continues to grow and grow. Describe that for us, that cultural district, and also tell us about the economic impact that it's had.
Yeah, and that's a real sort of jewel in the crown, I think, of the Harvey, Karen, Joe era, that they really wanted to build this very vital cultural hub, and that wasn't just about BAM, that was also about all these other organizations that moved to this part of Brooklyn in Fort Greene. Now I think there are more or less 60 organizations. It has a professional association, the Downtown Brooklyn Arts Alliance. The economic impact is hundreds of millions now, and we attract maybe 4 or 5 million visitors a year. The key companies of the district include Mark Morris Dance Group right across the street, Brick, Urban Glass, Theatre for a New Audience, the Brooklyn Music School, and scores of others. So it's an exciting and vibrant place to be. And it's also, again, speaking to that sort of great diversity of the borough, all the buildings and all the organizations are different. Their architecture is different. Their programs are different. Their budget sizes are different. It's a real sort of ecosystem of culture, which I love. I mean, it's very vital.
Yeah. Well, talking about buildings, you are underway a capital campaign, something called the BAM Strong Renovation Project. And what you're trying to do is improve site accessibility. And you're trying to enhance the experience, and not only for the audience, but also for the artists, which I think is interesting. Tell us where we stand and what's going to happen.
So, yes, this is a very exciting project. It's really about uniting the streetscape as well on Fulton Street, because we have an empty lot next to the Harvey, which we're going to be building out. And we actually own a condo on the corner. It's the only piece of real estate that BAM owns, because, as you know, we're part of the city's cultural institution group. So the city owns our buildings. And in partnership with the city, in fact, we're developing the BAM Strong, which will unite those buildings and really bring the Harvey Theatre, sort of the front of house amenities, into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And we famously have improved. I should say that the seats in the Harvey used to be wooden benches. And over the years, we have upgraded the seating in the Harvey. And we recently did that as well. And also we have we've never had a way of accessing the balcony very easily. So there are all kinds of accessibility missions built into this space. And I'm excited about it. It's going to be a very beautiful addition to the streetscape and to our campus. Mm-hmm. And we're also, as part of that complex, building space for our visual art program. So that empty lot next to the, in between the Harvey and the condo, will become a visual art gallery.
Would that be the Pam Karen, or is that something else?
No, that's part of the BAM Strong. Oh. All part of the same complex.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned a moment ago about trying to keep the balance as an international arts center.
Yes.
And really committed to the community of Brooklyn. Yep. How do you keep that balance? How do you think about that?
Well, again, I think about it in terms of, so there are two, I think, ways in which we think about programming at BAM in very broad terms. One is, what is the local and national, international community of artists really striving to do at the moment? What are the themes in their work? How are they pushing the envelope in their respective art forms? And then, as we're thinking about that and what the artists bring, how are we thinking about what our communities want to participate in? What do they want to see? How are those developing? How is Brooklyn developing? And I think it's the really sweet spot of marrying those two things. You know, Harvey always used to say, follow the artist, you know, follow the artist where they may go. And then you match that up with the audience. And so it's not as hard as it sounds maybe to match up the local and the national and the international. Also because Brooklyn is a very international borough. It's a borough now of 2.6 million people. 50% speak a language other than English at home, and 65% of people of color. So that really informs our programming. So that's how we think about it.
Some of your exciting program coming up is the Next Wave Festival, and I believe that's going to be running from October 3rd
yes.
to December 23rd.
Yes.
And this is going to be the final one that's curated by Pam's longtime executive
yep.
producer, Joseph Melillo.
Yep.
Tell us about the festival and tell us a little bit about Joe.
Well, Joe has had, I think, an unparalleled career as an executive producer. When I was searching for his successor, which has been a big project of mine over the last couple of years, recently concluded, I heard time and time again just how extraordinary it is to have one person who has put together 35 seasons of programming, which is an immense accomplishment.
It's incredible.
It's really an incredible accomplishment. So Joe is revered. He's a legend. His legacy is an astonishing one. And I think this last Next Wave Festival of Joe's reflects a lot of, you know, the enduring things that he has tried to do. Again, bringing art forms together, following the artist, you know, representing the careers of iconic artists like Trisha Brown, for example, mm-hmm. like Philip Glass. I'm looking at Satya Graha. And I think Mark Morris, of course, in The Hard Nut. And I think those reflect Joe's long-time preoccupations. It's a very bittersweet moment for us, I have to say, looking at Joe's last Next Wave.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a little bit about his successor.
His successor is a fantastic, wonderful man of the theater. His name is David Binder.
Mm-hmm.
We went all the way around the world and back again and found our next artistic director in New York City, in downtown New York City.
Right under your nose the whole time.
Right under my nose the whole time. I actually met him early in the search and, in fact, came back to Joe and said, Joe, I just met a really remarkable person. And Joe's eyes kind of lit up, which was also a wonderful thing to see.
For sure.
And David is a theater producer. Again, he came to New York after college. He put his roots down as a producer and produced an enormous number of and range of things, right up to the thing that he is most famous for, maybe, which was Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yeah.
And so he's a remarkable guy. And I think the thing that's remarkable about David and which he shares with Joe is huge curiosity that goes way beyond, you know, Broadway or theater, that goes to the dance community, the interdisciplinary community, performance art, visual art, music. I think he's an enormously eclectic person. And we really need that at BAM because, as you are surely hearing, we are nothing if not eclectic. So,
well, that's a wonderful characteristic,
yeah,
that curiosity
absolutely.
To bring to that post.
Yeah.
The organization, BAM, is so committed to making as many of your offerings available and affordable to the public as you possibly can. Tell us about some of your efforts in that regard.
So I think when it comes to figuring out how to attract audiences, and I talk a lot about accessibility. I talk about the physical accessibility of the buildings. I talk about the accessibility of the programming, the way we talk about our programming. I talk about how we work in partnership with our communities, what their assets are and how we work together. But it's also about pricing, of course.
Mm.
And, you know, the ticket prices for all our main stage engagements begin at $30. This does not include movie tickets. If you're a member as well, you can get half price everything. And so the Fisher space that I referenced earlier, there was a mandate there as well to have very affordable tickets. So those are $25 general admission tickets for the Next Wave Festival. We offer discounts to students and seniors and veterans. And actually, one of the big programs that we've participated in over the last few years is, of course, the city's IDNYC program, which has been a fantastic gateway for people to have a free membership to BAM for a year, which entitles them to a lot of discounts, and to get a sense of the institution to dip into all of those those different programming areas and then maybe to sign up at the end of the year. And I hear from a lot of people that that has been a really significant way to access the institution. And then, of course, we have free programming, such as the R&B Festival this summer. We have, you know, lots of other free programs. Like one of my favorites is our annual Halloween Festival, which yeah. which is called Bamboo. And I always bring that one up because I just like to say it. We have a fantastic program for senior cinema. Yesterday, I went into work, walked up through the Le Perc space, which is our big cafe space, and encountered, you know, hundreds of seniors dancing. So we have a whole range of programs.
Very sweet. Yeah,
yeah. It's the really great programs.
And you have a lot of visitors every year. How many?
We have a lot of visitors. We about 750,000 a year.
Wow. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
How is the digital realm and technology changing about how you go about what you do and how you
sure.
deliver your product? I tell you, I know you have a very popular YouTube channel.
We have a very popular YouTube channel. We work a lot through social media, of course, as many institutions do. We have another very popular feature of our social media engagement is when artists take over our Instagram for a couple of days or for the time that
That's
they're
cool.
at BAM. It's very cool. It's very fun. So, you know, we use technology to distribute things. We use technology to connect to audiences. One of the things I think is very interesting about BAM, though, as we were talking earlier about interdisciplinary work and following the artist, is how artists also incorporate technology into their work.
Hmm.
You know, we obviously show things like HD platforms, like the Met HD platform, the National Theatre Live in our movie theatres. But actually on the main stage, you will often see artists using technology in their work. And I find that a particularly fascinating thing about BAM. We also use it a lot in our education programs. We use it to connect classrooms, to connect children and students that are, and families that are working on different kinds of programs. We have a great after-school program called Arts and Justice, where we famously connected a group of Brooklyn teenagers with teenagers in St. Louis around the time of the troubles there a few years ago in Ferguson. And so I think, you know, technology is a great way to bring students together. We have virtual classrooms. We have productions that we've made available in that way. So again, you know, technology is the great connector, but it is also a great artistic initiative as well for us.
Sounds like a pretty big operation you got going on.
It really is. It's like when I first got to BAM, I would say that the story of my first year was really understanding the full depth of the programming. One other strand that we should maybe touch on is that places, BAM has always been a place for where people convene to talk.
Mm-hmm.
It's a chatty, discursive organization. People like to meet and talk about the issues of the day. And actually one of the, we didn't talk much about the first 100 years of BAM, but there were many people that came during that time to give lectures, to talk, to convene. And that endures to this day. We have a lot of programs, literary programs where we bring people together to talk. And so that's another feature of the organization. The staff are also exemplify that trait, too.
I bet they do. You know, you touched on the diversity in Brooklyn and what
yes.
an incredible borough it is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
diversity is one of the most important things
yep.
that is facing arts institutions yep. today. Diversity in programming and yep. audiences and staff, and most certainly the board.
Yeah.
Tell us about how you think about that and what are some of the things you're doing to achieve greater diversity.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think this has been, if somebody was to ask me what's the subject that's come up every single day since you've been at BAM, other than perhaps, you know, the challenges of finding the money. Which I'm sure we'll talk about also, is really this challenge. And I think this is a central challenge. It's one of the most, as you reference, it's one of the most important and deep and complicated challenges that we face. I find that BAM naturally leans into this issue
mm-hmm.
In really good ways because I think it sits very consciously in a very diverse community. And one of the things that we've been working on internally and with the board is finding the right language and sort of knowledge to talk about these issues with authority. I think diversity is complicated. You're talking about ethnicity and gender and sexuality and people with disabilities and the LGBTQ community and socioeconomic diversity. It's an enormously complicated subject.
It certainly is.
And I think it's incumbent on all of us to continually be educating ourselves about that. And I think if you are a learning organization in that space, and again, you're following the art artists and where they lead you, you will come to naturally embrace an awful lot of this. I believe that if you do not fully embrace all of those underrepresented narratives, those by people of color and also by women, you are leaving, you know, huge artistic riches, you know, off the table. You know, you're leaving things to the side that you should not be leaving to the side. So I believe that it enriches organizations to take into account as bigger a number of perspectives as you possibly can. And we work on that every single day.
You're never going to get there. It's always going to be a work in progress.
Yes.
And despite the challenges you have, it just seems that BAM has it a little bit more in their DNA than many other arts organizations, just based on your history, where you're located, and the kind of work you've done for 150 years.
And I think it's also important that you can be flexible in your partnerships, and also that there's longevity in this. We're not going away.
Yeah.
We are here by the grace of our community in some ways. We're here to serve. And I think if you keep those things in mind as well, you never get far away from you know, wanting to make people feel like this is their home. This is a place that anybody can come.
Well, one of the things that keep you from going away is money.
Exactly.
I get to BAM, let me just talk about the nonprofit arts sector in America.
Yeah.
And it certainly is struggling. I think part of public arts funding is probably down 15% or so in the last 20 years. And then we think of private philanthropy, but with all the private philanthropy, less than 5% of it goes to the arts. And, you know, despite the best efforts and despite all the evidence, people still sometimes consider the arts something that's nice to have, but really not critical or needed. How severe is this problem, and what can be done to successfully address it?
So I always talk about this thing, if you don't mind, in a kind of, you know, there's the glass half full and the glass half empty way of looking at this. And the glass half empty, just the challenges for a minute for me and I think my colleagues in the field are that the two things that really sort of box you in, I think, are the lack of a national conversation around the importance of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that especially when I go to other countries, I feel like there are not champions of the arts at the highest levels of the national conversation. And that, you know, with the huge struggles for comprehensive arts education, you have it at sort of both ends of the spectrum, right? And so the people that are running the big arts organizations in the country, I think, have become, you know, stewards and advocates for the importance of the arts in really critical ways.
Yeah.
And I see my role as much as to do all the things that we've just been talking about, but also to advocate for the huge importance of the arts, the way arts, I heard this phrase last week, bind people to each other and to community.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a mission that I have to, you know, espouse every day and talk about every day, because it's not getting talked about in other very critical parts of our society. And that's the, and you know, and when that happens, it's not surprising that you don't see the philanthropy following, right? And so I think that's the glass half empty. The glass half full for me is that I've had the fortune, I think, of having most of my professional career as a fundraiser be in New York City. And this is a city of incredible resources, of incredible generosity. I am, you know, I couldn't do what I do if I wasn't inspired daily by acts of philanthropy and generosity by this community. And I remain, you know, as a fundraiser, eternally optimistic about our ability to make the cases that we've been talking about today to philanthropists in this city, because I think there are people who desperately care about the importance of the arts here for all kinds of reasons. Somebody once told me to go away and make a list of all the reasons that somebody gives to an organization. They said, and let me give you a clue, it's not necessarily because they love your programming. it's such a wide range of things. And I think if you embrace all of the reasons why people give, this city is actually a wonderful place to be a fundraiser. And so there are I keep those two things in my mind every day, the challenge and also the opportunity.
Well, the reasons for giving is just as eclectic as BAM is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your business model. I know Bloomberg Philanthropies just underwrote and sponsored your winter-spring season. But what are those different streams of revenue that allow you to do what you do? And I mean, is there any one of them that you think hold particular promise in fueling the growth of BAM going forward?
I like to think that we do have a diversified portfolio that helps me to sleep at night. We're a 60-40 organization in terms of earned to contributed, 60 contributed, 40 earned. In that contributed mix, you'll find the regular mix. And we're not heavily dependent on any one stream, except that I will say that individual philanthropy is the growing trend.
Yeah.
I want to do a shout out actually for something that is also the privilege of being in this city, which is the public-private partnership that we have with the city. The city have been and continue to be incredible supporters of BAM. They were, I think they put in more than $100 million into the cultural district.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that public-private partnership has been an incredibly powerful one in this particular case and continues to be so. So we're very, very, very proud of that. The city is very generous in terms of capital. It helps support the buildings that it owns.
Yep.
They're a great, great partner. Other than that, on the private philanthropy side, we see the regular mix of foundation corporate, but again, individual philanthropy being the growing trend.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this. You've been the president now for 3 years or
yes.
so, 3 years in August. You got a new executive producer coming
yes.
in.
Yes.
Time of great change.
Yep.
What are some of the new elements you're bringing or are planning to bring still to the Brooklyn Academy of Music?
So I think the answer to that question happily lies in a lot of the things that we've talked about, right? This is an organization that never stops evolving. It never sits on its laurels. So I think, you know, the challenges of diversity sit at the heart, you know, the continual balancing of those, all of those competing narratives going forward will be a big challenge. I think we're interested in exploring what happens when the BAM brand goes walkabout a little bit. So you might expect to see us a little bit off campus, which would be a very big thing for us. That would be interesting. I think the curatorial structure of the organization will broaden out naturally from Joe's vision to the vision that the multiple curators will have. We now exist in three very, very big buckets: education and community programming, performing arts, and the movies. And I think mm-hmm. if I could allude to one big area of growth, it would be in film, because this next space that we're going to bring online, the fourth part of our campus, will be the BAM Karen. That will be a home for our archive, for more educational immersive technology space, but also more movie theaters. And I think we're developing a really strong point of view of what it means to be a very large independent movie center at the heart of a very complex community. And we just opened our film festival last night with a fantastic movie called Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley. And I think that those three big programming areas will all develop and grow in their own way over the next few years. So I would expect to see a larger imprint, again, BAM off campus, a wider curatorial vision, and otherwise, again, enduring things like hybridity and experimentation and huge diversity in the programming.
Interesting times.
Very interesting.
And you're an interesting
times.
Leader. Katie Clark, the president of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, tell us about your website and all that visitors can find on it.
BAM.org. The first thing you will see is really how to buy a movie ticket and then how to buy tickets to everything that's coming up. You'll also find information about free programs, community programming, how to become a member of BAM. We love our members. How to donate to BAM, how to become a BAM fan.
There you go. Well, thanks, Katie. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society, the same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
It is said that ballet is a dance executed by the human soul, and that ballet dancers are among the greatest living athletes. American Ballet Theatre, located here in New York, is considered to be one of the great dance companies in the world. And in 2006, by an act of Congress, it became America's national ballet company. And it's a great pleasure to have with us their executive director, Kara Medoff-Barnett. Good evening, Kara, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. Thrilled to be here.
ABT was founded back in 1939. That's almost 80 years ago. Share with us a little bit of the history of American Ballet Theatre.
Absolutely. Well, it's an honor to serve this organization as we approach our 80th birthday. I've only been with the organization for 2 years, but I've admired it ever since I was a little girl coming to see the ballet with my mother. I grew up in North Carolina and always admired ABT, had posters of American Ballet Theater dancers on my walls. So it really is a thrill to now be part of this organization. The company, as you mentioned, was organized in 1939, had its first public performance in January of 1940. Founded by a woman or formidable female leader named Lucia Chase, the company was founded to really bring together talent from around the world and to form this American company that had an eclectic repertoire that preserved the classics of the art form, but also that worked with the greatest living creators, with incredible choreographers and designers and composers, and brought them together to extend the art form of classical ballet. And so we continue in that tradition today, and our mission is not only to preserve the great classics of the past, but to extend the canon of classical dance.
Mm-hmm. And why don't you inspire us, Kara, and give us some appreciation of ballet? I mean, the essence of the art form, the form of communication, the dancers themselves.
Well, I think ballet is a primal form of communication. Uh-huh. It is the movement of human bodies through space, and American Ballet Theater does that in a unique way because of the theater part of our name. Mm-hmm. Dancers join American Ballet Theater because they want to tell stories. Sometimes those stories are clear narratives, whether it's Romeo and Juliet or Swan Lake. Sometimes they're more abstract, but the dancers embody characters, embody feelings, embody relationships. And I've always enjoyed in watching American Ballet Theater how you get to know these individuals, how you come to see how they approach the art and the art form and the storytelling as actors. And our dancers really pride themselves on their acting. And I think that the theater part of our name really sets us apart. I also think that the athleticism of the dancers is something that inspires broad audiences. I know that my husband, who's a former athlete, always remarks to me after he goes to the ballet, wow, what they can do with their bodies. Yeah. And how they can control their bodies, how they can make it look so easy and effortless. Maybe the energy expended is similar to what a pro athlete might expend in a soccer match or a basketball game, but they're allowed to sweat. They're allowed to put their hands on their knees and take a breather. These dancers are out there embodying these characters, telling these stories, and making it all look graceful and effortless. So I am consistently inspired by the storytelling and the artistry, but I'm also inspired by the athleticism and the sheer strength and strength paired with grace of the ballet dancers in American Ballet Theater.
Yeah, I think you've even said that the product you bring the public every day is perfection, right?
Well, I think that we strive for perfection. Yeah. And that certainly is, I think, the aspiration. I think that dancers in general are perfectionists, but they also realize that perfection is elusive. And that's why mm-hmm. they show up every morning and start their day with the ritual of ballet class. They are always striving to be better, to be stronger, to perfect their technique, to extend what's possible for them in their bodies, and working together as a cohesive whole, as a team, to elevate this art form that we all revere, but that we all want people to enjoy. And so how do you strive for, perhaps you strive almost beyond perfection, because perfection is too safe. I think that we're striving for an ideal, striving for a feeling, striving for that elusive, transcendent joy that we have the great privilege of experiencing in the theater many times a year, and sometimes even many times a week, when you have the opportunity to experience what it is that this company does, what it is that ABT brings to life on stage when the lights go down and the curtain rises.
Speaking of enjoy, do you have a favorite ballet?
Well, you're not supposed to have a favorite when you're the executive director. I think it's kind of like having a favorite child when you're a mother. But I will say that Romeo and Juliet brings me to tears every single time I see it. And I came to ballet after a career in the theater. I produced Broadway and Off-Broadway theater, and I've seen a lot of Romeo and Juliet. many. Live theater, on screen. There is nothing like the ballet Romeo and Juliet.
Gets
Kenneth
every
McMillan's
time.
With the Prokofiev score, and to see these different dancers inhabit the roles, and not only to inhabit the roles of Romeo and Juliet, but of Lady Capulet and of Tybalt and of Paris and of Mercutio. Mm-hmm. Each time I see it, the chemistry is different. What the dancers bring to the drama is different, and it always moves me. So I have to say Romeo and Juliet. Close.
But you're not allowed to say Romeo and Juliet.
And then I'll tell you 12 close second places.
Okay. Well, what is the current state of ballet in 2018? It always seemed that it had a golden period with Brezhnikov back in the 60s, 70s, whenever that was, and sort of fell out of favor. But there seems to be a bit of a resurgence. Now, that's just my assessment, which isn't very good. What is your assessment?
My assessment is that it's more than a resurgence. Mm. I think that ballet is hot right now. I think that ballet is exciting for our audiences, and we're attracting a younger and more diverse audience than ever before. I think that part of that is because ballet looks great on a small screen. And so the power of social media, the power of video is working in our favor. It is not working in the favor of every classical art form. Mm-hmm. I think that theater, opera, classical music, it's hard to capture those art forms in a short form way on a small screen that makes the viewer say, I've got to go see that. I have to experience that. You can watch 6 seconds of ballet or 6 minutes of ballet or 30 seconds of a dancer leaping or spinning or balancing.
And you're hooked.
On your phone, and you're hooked. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have a very powerful tool, and we are only scratching the surface of how best to use it to attract and inspire and spark the curiosity of new audiences for this art form.
You know, you went to Duke planning to follow in your dad's footsteps and become a doctor. So you're taking pre-med and you're working on the emergency response vehicle. How in the world did that ride on the ambulance ultimately take you all the way to New York and becoming the executive director of American Ballet Theater?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think that the common thread is the adrenaline. Whether you're on an ambulance or you're backstage at the Met, there's a lot happening all at once. And someone's got to coordinate that activity. So I think there are some similarities. But I did think that I wanted to be a doctor. And what attracted me about practicing medicine was caring for others and taking care of other human beings. And I think that I have certainly shifted from taking care of their bodies to hopefully tending to the human spirit by sustaining this art form and by bringing it to the lives of our not only our dancers and our artists, our staff members, our students in our school, and our audiences in New York and around the world. I think that when I stopped, when I came home one vacation and told my parents that instead of being a doctor, I was going to be a theater producer, that shift for me was that I didn't want to spend the next several years in the lab. Mm-hmm. I really craved interaction with other human beings. And when I discovered that there were roles in the arts where I could use my talents and skills, which certainly were not on the stage but were behind the scenes, in a way that could build community and could create an environment in which artists could thrive, that to me became tremendously exciting and I think became a calling.
Yeah, yeah. And your folks were cool with that decision to boot.
My folks were amazing.
Yeah.
They were supportive. I think they were stunned and astonished and ultimately believed that I could do whatever I set my mind to doing. And I think part of that was because I had trained as a dancer as a kid and they had seen the fierce determination and discipline that I had developed in the studio. And they knew that if I set my mind to something, that I would pursue it all in. And so they continued to put LSAT books and GMAT books on my bed when I would visit my home in North Carolina, but they also really loved coming up to New York for the opening night.
Yeah, I bet. Well, the artistic director of ABT is Kevin McKenzie, and he's held that post, I think, since 1992. Tell us a little bit about him and the relationship between an artistic director and an executive director in a performing arts organization.
Sure. Well, I feel very blessed to have Kevin McKenzie as a partner, as a guru, as I learn the intricacies and the history and the legacy of this company and this art form. I think it was perhaps a bit intimidating when I realized that I would be coming into an organization not only that had 75 years of history and legacy, but an artistic director who had almost 25 years mm-hmm. as the artistic leader, and before that had been a principal dancer with the company. Here was someone who knew so much more about ballet than I did. And Kevin has been, from day one, patient, has been kind, has been welcoming, has been supportive, and I think is one of the most entrepreneurial leaders you'll ever meet. When I frame an idea and say, Kevin, this might be crazy, but how about, he says, tell me 10 good reasons why not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm deeply grateful for the sense of possibility that he brings to every conversation, to every decision, and also to the community that he's created at ABT. This is a company that's had its ups and downs over the decades, that has, by force of sheer will, survived many of the tumultuous periods in its history. And Kevin has been a steady center and has been a source of strength for the artistic enterprise. And the dancers adore him.
Mm.
He has truly built so many careers and has also built a sense of pride and camaraderie and kindness and mutual respect in the artistic organization at ABT. It's something I've never experienced in my entire career in the performing arts. Kevin has created a remarkable community.
You also have an artist in residence, don't you? Tell us about him and the role that he plays in the company.
Sure. So Alexei Ratmansky is our artist in residence,
mm-hmm.
and he is a genius. The MacArthur Foundation said that, so I can say it too. But it's extraordinary to have someone like Alexei in our midst, creating new work on our dancers with our team. And he is just he's an engine. He pushes us to think boldly, to plan ambitiously, and he really brings out of the dancers things that no one thought was possible, whether he's asking them to inhabit a more refined style of the turn of the century when he recreates something like Petipa's Sleeping Beauty,
mm-hmm.
or more recently Petipa's Harlequinade, which he did for us this spring season. When he does that, he is studying the master and unpacking the notes of Petipa and really asking the dancers to go back into another time. He takes the artists and the audiences into a time capsule. And then he uses that knowledge that he gains from studying the master to create some of the most exciting and extraordinary works of art that I've ever witnessed. So Whipped Cream, which is a ballet he created for us last year, is set to a Richard Strauss score from the 20s. But the movement vocabulary and the sense of humor, very much 2017. It's whimsical and it's fanciful and it's fun and it's hard. The dancers are being asked to do things and fit more movements into a phrase of music than anyone thinks is humanly possible. But Alexei thinks it's possible, and therefore it must be so. And he brings to the table just brilliant collaborators like Mark Ryden, mm-hmm. the pop surrealist artist who created the sets and costumes for Whipped Cream. And Alexei says, this is the guy. He's going to create this magical world where sweets come to life. And that's what happened. And all of a sudden, we have dancers entering by slide, dancers in white unitards who become the whipped cream of the title because they're spinning like an electric mixer, just whisking up the cream, and they're entering by slide. It's hilarious. It's brilliant. It's transporting, and it all comes out of the brilliant mind of Alexei Ratmansky.
And it's playing this coming week, by the way, and that will be the close of your spring season. But you've just announced your fall season. So tell us about that, what's in store, and also where do you perform?
Sure. So the fall season for ABT is where we have even more space to extend the canon. So we are doing several world premieres this fall. We do 2 weeks at the David Koch Theater at Lincoln Center in October. We open on October 17th. And this fall, we're focusing on female creators and women choreographers as part of the ABT Women's Movement. So ABT, as I mentioned earlier, founded by a woman, founded by Lucia Chase. Agnes DeMille had a piece on our very first program in 1940. Twyla Tharp has created many of her great pieces for ABT. So we've certainly had powerful and brilliant women creating for ABT over the decades. But in recent years, Kevin McKinsey has decided to focus on supporting and advancing and propelling the opportunities for women choreographers. So this fall, we will have a world premiere by Michelle Dorrance, the tap dancer and choreographer who created her first piece for ABT this spring at the Met. We will have a new piece by Jessica Lang, who's been working with ABT on and off for 20 years. And she will collaborate with Sarah Crowner, an incredible visual artist based in Brooklyn. And we will also bring back some favorites by Twyla Tharp. We will put on the stage at the Koch Theater a piece that Lauren Lovett created for the ABT Studio Company. And in addition, we'll celebrate Jerome Robbins with Fancy Free and other dances. So we'll have some old favorites mixed with some cutting-edge, exciting new work. And I am just, while we have 2 weeks left in our spring season, I am counting down the days till October so that I can see all of these new works come to life on the ABT dancers. It's 2 weeks of intense fun and energy and vibrancy and eclecticism in the in the spirit of how this company was founded, to have a vibrant and diverse repertoire and work with the most talented creators of our time who are working in dance. So
it sounds like a wonderful blend. You have a couple other programs there, and I want to talk about those. One, in your effort to increase diversity and inclusion, you launched something called Project Plié maybe about 5 years ago. How do you go about this, and how successful has it been, Kara?
So Project Plié is our initiative to expand ethnic and racial diversity and representation in classical ballet. And this was started under my predecessor, and it's something that I am deeply committed to and that the entire organization is committed to. And we certainly focus on the talent pipeline in our school, in our summer programs, in our training programs, because we want to see diversity on the stage. We also are focused on diversity behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And that's an area where I've been working closely with colleagues and drawing on the learnings of experts to figure out how we can also expand diversity in our administrative staff, in our internship programs, in our board of directors, in our leadership.
That's always so key.
And also in our audiences. How can we think about this holistically so that we not only are supporting ballet teachers working in communities of color, and not only so that we can support and advance the careers of dancers of color, but how can we also make it possible for individuals from underrepresented communities to pursue careers in this art form and in the performing arts in many of the different jobs and roles and leadership positions that we have available? So we are actively propelling Project Plié and also thinking about what's next. How do we build on the early success of Project Plié, which now has us in over 40 cities working with Boys and Girls Clubs and introducing the magic of ballet? What's next? What's Project Plié 2.0 so that we can really make this a 360-degree approach to diversity and inclusion? It's incumbent on us as America's National Ballet Company to find ways to reflect America and American diversity and American dynamism.
Absolutely. And I also saw a couple weeks ago you announced a new choreography initiative called ABT Incubator. How is that going to work?
Well, this is tremendously exciting. It's all about extending the canon. It's all about finding new creative talent from within, and also identifying choreographers who maybe haven't yet had the opportunity to work with American Ballet Theatre dancers. So this is propelled by David Hallberg, one of our principal dancers. And the idea is a workshop, a very private but intense opportunity for ABT dancers to try their hand at choreography. And David and Kevin McKenzie will also be inviting in one or two choreographers from the outside to work with the ABT dancers. It'll be a two-week workshop in late October, early November. And we want to bring new movement vocabularies, to bring new choreographic ideas into the ABT ecosystem and see what percolates, see what emerges.
What happens?
So we're not making any predictions. We are just saying, let's put talented people in a room, talented dancers, talented choreographers, and see what happens. And I think that there are many different paths that the pieces created could take. We are committed to doing this every year and to growing the program in the future.
Very cool initiative. You know, like so many nonprofit organizations, Kara, so much time and money and effort is dedicated to the service or the product, or in your case, the performance. Everything goes on the stage. And when that happens, sometimes the infrastructure or the scaffolding that helps support all that work goes a little neglected. And I know that's a bit of the situation you found when you came to ABT. What are some of the steps you're taking to sort of strengthen and revitalize that infrastructure?
Sure. So ABT is an organization that is almost 80 years old, and it is remarkable that the artistry on the stage, when that curtain rises, it is
magical.
Glory.
Mm-hmm.
It is glorious. It is magical. And as you mentioned, there's perhaps some deferred maintenance behind the scenes on that scaffolding, even while we continue to support that magic on the stage. And so I have been committed together with Kevin and my colleagues and our board of trustees to strengthening our infrastructure, strengthening our foundations so that we can continue to have that magic when the curtain rises for many generations to come. So we think about infrastructure in several different buckets. One is our physical infrastructure, our home. We've been at 890 Broadway since 1980. And so we have done a few really exciting upgrades to our home.
Sure, the lounge in particular.
The lounge, which you referenced, which we were thrilled to collaborate with Architectural Digest to create a common space, a community gathering space that is really beautiful and inviting, and a place where our dancers, our staff, our donors can come together and spend time building community. It is the only gathering space that we have in our home, and so we are thrilled that, thanks to Architectural Digest, it now is really an elegant place to be together.
And everything was donated, which is spectacular.
Everything was donated. Mm-hmm. We had an anonymous donor who provided some of the basic infrastructure, and then Architectural Digest brought many sponsors to the table who just made it it is the living room that you and I probably wish we had in our homes, but luckily I now have it at my office at ABT's headquarters.
Which sometimes is your home.
Exactly. My second home. And so one is our place, and just being proud of the place that we all go to work every day. Number two is the people, and thinking about our staff structure and thinking about our board of trustees, and how can we recruit and retain top talent at all levels. Certainly Kevin is always thinking about recruitment and retention of our artists and our dancers, but how do we make sure that our staff is as excellent, that everyone is A-plus, top tier, and that we have the right functions in place to be able to deliver on our ambitious goals. Number three is our digital infrastructure. I inherited a website that I think was over a decade old and was not mobily enabled. And if we want to be able to communicate with our fans, with our audiences, with our broad community, our mission is to reach the widest possible audience. In today's day and age, you can't reach the widest possible audience if you have an antique and unreliable website. So we were fortunate to have a website donated by one of our trustees this past year. So if you visit abt.org, it'll work on your mobile phone. And
that's
it actually is quite easy to navigate and to find information.
You just gave it a facelift. As you said, also you have an art form that really sells on your mobile phone.
Absolutely. And so we're thrilled to have a new digital backbone. And now we are investing in video and in building assets to fill that new digital home. We talk about it as a home that now needs furniture. So now we're now we're going to build some of the video furniture that can fill that home and decorate it and make it a place that people want to hang out. And then the financial infrastructure is also an area where I think we have room for improvement, and we've certainly made some major strides in recent years, really investing in new work and investing in ABT's future.
Mm-hmm. Let me pick up on what you said about the world, and let me get you out on this. You were at Lincoln Center before assuming this position at ABT, and your job there was building out the international arm of Lincoln Center. So what's your thinking around ABT and the role that it should play as a cultural ambassador of the United States around the globe, and also your vision for the organization as you head into your centennial 20 years hence?
I was very fortunate at Lincoln Center to start Lincoln Center International and to work with leaders around the world, government leaders, philanthropic leaders, leaders in education who were investing in the future of art and culture in their communities. Now, often they were investing in the hardware. They were investing in the new opera houses and concert halls and cultural districts, and we had the opportunity to advise them and collaborate with them. Now at ABT, I feel like I've moved from working for the arena to working for the team. And so what we have at American Ballet Theatre is a collection of individuals, of individual artists who together bring the arts and the experience of the arts to life. And the art form that we have the great honor of extending and bringing to the widest possible audience is an art form that doesn't require language, that is, as I said earlier, a primal form of communication. So we are perfectly positioned to be cultural ambassadors. We have dancers from 27 states and 16 countries in the company right now. So that means that anywhere we go, when we tour around the country and across the world, we have a hometown hero.
Yeah.
We have someone who can speak the local language and talk about what it is that we do. We have individuals who reflect the communities in which we're performing. And so as a magnet for talent and also as a provider of transcendent experiences, of joyful experiences of art that take us out of our daily lives and show us what's possible, that show us the limitlessness, is that a word? of human experience and achievement. We really, when we travel, whether it's to Muscat in Oman, whether it's to Hong Kong and Singapore, where we just were with Whipped Cream and Swan Lake, whether it's to Lincoln, Nebraska, where we had two sold-out shows of Firebird this past spring. In all of these places, we, I believe, are bringing the best of America and the best of what it means to have a community of talent that works together as a team to bring joy to audiences. And I think that there is something in that that's very powerful, that is, I believe, unique in this world where communication can be challenged at times across borders and boundaries.
Sure.
Even within our own country, there's so much animosity right now. But across political lines, across all sorts of borders and boundaries, the language of ballet and the storytelling and artistry and vibrancy and vitality of American Ballet Theatre brings communities together. When we fill those opera houses and theaters around the world, this team fills those arenas with a sense of possibility and a sense of community that I think is deeply important in our world today and tomorrow.
Well, Kara Madoff-Barnett, the Executive Director of American Ballet Theatre, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about that new website of yours. years and whipped cream. Now, I know that's playing this week. Is it still possible to get tickets?
If you act quickly, it's a tremendously fun way to spend a couple of hours out of the heat and inside the air conditioning of the Metropolitan Opera House. It is a ballet about a boy who eats too many sweets after his confirmation. He goes with his friends to a pastry shop, eats too many sweets, too much whipped cream, falls ill, and retreats into his dreams where all of the sweets come to life. So you have Princess Praline and you have Prince Coffee, and it is fanciful. It is fun. The dancing is extraordinary, and I do highly recommend it. And it's terrific for people of all ages. So my kids, I have three young daughters who adore this ballet, but it might be my husband's favorite ballet too. I think that shows.
And he's allowed to have
chocolate. He absolutely is. And it really also demonstrates the innovation that we're committed to at American Ballet Theatre of creating new classics. And I think that this truly is one. So don't miss it. It's
absolutely
great fun.
Sounds like a hoot, and act quickly. Well, thank you, Kara. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Morgan Dixon, the CEO of Girl Trek, a national health movement that activates thousands and thousands of black women to be change makers in their lives and communities through walking. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.